You're listening to The Brian D. O'Leary Show, your sanctuary for serious content in an unserious culture.
All right, Brian O'Leary here with you today with Scott Fishbuck, who is a Jungian typology expert. We've had him on the show in the past, and we got to know a little bit about Scott's story, how he got there and whatnot. But today, as per the promise of probably about a year ago, Scott, I think, but a little more perhaps, I wanted to have you back on to do what you do best for me. And you agreed to do that, which is to type me and how you do your business, which is called toolswithscott.com. The website's there. We've got a website that will be updated, or maybe a brand new one, I believe.
Yeah, which is cool. It includes a lot of... So originally the first website, I hadn't had a website, and then I wanted to do a retreat. And so I made a website just for the retreat, basically, okay. Which went very well. And now I'm building out a website that includes a more robust explanation of what I'm doing and how I do it, and then how to get in... Just a regular business website. It right. just sounds like a big deal to me since I haven't done it before. But yeah.
Coming soon, shall we say, which, and then on there, your offerings would be one-on-one consulting and or coaching, depending on how you label that or how the client labels it. Corporate mm-hmm. consulting, the one-on-one stuff really focuses on personal growth and a little bit of encouragement, I think, based on your typology, right? And then the corporate consulting is to kind of get your teams working in conjunction with each other, a little more fluidly, I believe you say.
Yeah.
Today, what I had in mind, and I think we came to a consensus of the minds, is that we will dive in head first to step one of what Scott Fishbuck does on his one-on-one personal consulting, and we'll get a little flavor of what he does. And I'm an open book here, as far as I know. And Scott's just going to do his work for us today. And it's like step one of Scott's program. So a little flavor of what you might get working with Scott. And I know that a lot of people that I work with also work with Scott, and nothing but good feedback. So here we go, Scott. I'm going to give you the floor.
High praise. So basically for prior to meeting, I would have a brief preamble, which is basically, we're just going to talk. Uh-huh. And my job while we're talking is to pay attention to certain preferences in conversation and certain topics that they prefer, certain turns of phrase. And that might sound really nondescript and kind of vague, but they fall into different categories, just like ingredients in a recipe. And I can say, okay, here's this ingredient. Here's this ingredient. These ingredients go into a soup. These ingredients make up bread, right? And so that's exactly what I'm doing, except the ingredients in this case are topics, turns of phrase, certain behavioral mannerisms, and so on. And then at the end, we say, this is a biscuit, or this is a, right? And then to pause, there's lots of types of biscuits, but this is a biscuit. Okay, I don't want to get lost in that analogy.
They say, taste the biscuit. There's a nice internet meme going around, taste the
biscuit.
I got a quick question here. If I have a question, can I stop you, or would
Absolutely.
You just prefer me to just, all right. So one quick question. You say turns of phrase. Could that not only be personality typing, but what region of the country or the world you're from? Or are we talking about something entirely different?
Yeah, absolutely. There's okay. completely a cultural overlay onto a personality type.
Yeah, you take somebody from that has an idiom from the Northeast and put them in the Southwest, and they don't know what they're talking about. It's the same thing if you go from the United States to Australia or England or whatever. I don't have any idea what you're saying.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So absolutely, cultural norms and preferences influence the way a person develops, the type of parents they have. Everything influences a person's personality. What mm-hmm. I'm getting at is not those influences, but the core wiring that okay. those influences are a part of. So think of what I'm doing is I'm finding the make and model of your car, but what you've done and where you've been and who you've driven with, that's a completely different sphere. Right? So you could go off-roading with a minivan if you wanted to. Most minivans don't do that, but you could. And so what I'm trying to say is this is a minivan. Okay. All right, well, let's roll. Let's do it. So tell me a little bit about what inspired your podcast. And remember, for the listener, what I'm trying to do is just pay attention to, okay, it makes it a little less organic when I have to do the explanation, kind of like a comedian explaining
it's
why
fine.
The joke's funny.
Yeah, it's yeah. fine.
Okay, cool.
This is a masterclass, Scott. What you're doing.
It's a masterclass.
Well, I will answer the question. I don't know if I've actually answered it on this podcast. I have on others, but what inspired me to do podcasting in general is that I don't know the initial kernel. However, I started listening to podcasts long ago, like before podcasts, I even had a pod or a phone to where I listened to them on the computer because it was like a lot of times just radio shows clipped down to listen to in reasonable size. And I was like, oh man, that's kind of neat. And then people actually had podcasts. I'm like, oh, that's cool. I always kind of wanted to do radio, but I didn't know how to do it. And then fast forward like 10 years, I had this in the back of my mind that I love to get into radio and maybe a podcast might be a cool thing. I never did anything about it, Scott. I never did anything. I was like, oh, that'd be cool. I don't even know where to start. And then in 2020, saw the world collapsing and I'm like, I better start doing what I want to do or need to do right now, because I don't know if I'm ever going to get a chance to do it again. So I called up a buddy of mine. I said, I've been thinking about doing this sports podcast for about 5 years, 10 years. I don't even know. Do you want to do it with me? He's like, that'd be awesome. Let's do it. So we recorded the first, or we did episode one, sat down, talked about some things. There was no sports going on, by the way. And it was called Sportlanders Podcast. And we didn't even record the first episode because neither of us could figure out how to do that. It's not that hard, but it's just like one of those stumbling blocks. Anyway, fast forward a few months. He doesn't have time to do it. I barely have time to do it, but I really like doing it. It like scratched an itch. So I continued to podcast about sports until it got to the point where I'm just like, I can't do this on a regular basis because it's not as important to me as a lot of other things going on in the culture. And so sports kind of took a back seat, and that was my life. And so I got in the Tom Woods School of Life, and we started these accountability groups that you and I are now in one together. And I said, well, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm not going to podcast anymore just because I don't want to do sports. They're like, you got a podcast. Like, you got the setup. You got it all. And I said, well, I don't really have any idea what I'm going to podcast about. And so they're like, you better just come up with an idea and present it to us next week. I'm like, oh boy, well, I'm going to get to work. So I'd been writing a bunch of emails. And so I just read an email and put it out as a podcast, a little bit of commentary. Then I got Jeremy Evans on my podcast. And then they're like, all right, what is your podcast about? I'm like, I don't know. And I said, well, I'm going to have about 100 of you people on the show. And that's going to inform my direction. And Scott, you were one of the early ones on the show. Also, and I think we've got like 25 or 30 folks from the Tom Woods School of Life to tell their story on the program here, which is great. And it allowed me to keep doing this and have an inspiration to keep doing this, along with speaking my own mind. And then it also opened up other doors to work more actually ironically within the Tom Woods School of Life that something I was never expecting, but it's wonderful that I get to meet with dozens of people every week and hear their stories, not on a public consumption podcast, but just like going back and forth and learn how to attack life, which is exactly what you do. And anyway, long story short is that keeps me going also. to keep this podcast going and get my voice out there and get the voices of other people that I know that are inspiring out there. So anyway, I hope that answered the question.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're, so first off, I've done it enough where I can do the thing and also listen. Really inspiring story, really cool. And then within that, I have all of the little analytics going on. So now we can talk a little bit about some things that I noticed. So first, you most of what you're relaying as you're talking about is your subjective personal experience in relation to the past. You were able to hop back into the past and say, this happened, then this happened, then this happened. And then they all kind of came from you as a subjective source. So if that sounds confusing, what I mean is if you were at a, and just to label that, that's called introverted sensing. And so let's compare, let's contrast that with a preference or a focus on the experience of other people to the exclusion of your own personal subjective awareness. So think about knowing what makes you comfortable versus knowing what makes someone else comfortable. Knowing what you've experienced in the past versus paying attention to what other people are experiencing. It's a, so that's the distinction line. So that's one thing I observed. And so if you're an introverted sensor, you're also an extroverted intuitive. And so what that means is what I want is not clear to me. What I want is not clear to me, but what I do prioritize is what other people want to do. So I want to be a facilitator of the goals and interests of others by preference. It doesn't mean you will always do that. It just means it's a natural fit. It feels good to be delivering on what other people want. Yeah. What do other people desire? Can I fulfill those goals and desires? And so that's the introverted sensing, extrovert intuition axis. They flow together. We won't worry about explaining that in depth, but half of the personality types have that axis. The other half have a different one. Okay. So right now we're down to 8. So as you're talking, you are staying on topic. Anyone who is listening to you. So I presented the question as what inspired you to do the podcast? You said, here are the things relating to the movement of the podcast in my experience, what drove me to do it, what the inspirations are, what key events happened in that movement. You stayed on topic throughout the entire arc of what you were saying. So that is called direct communication. And then also in that same vein, we have responding. So we have direct and responding. I am an informative communicator, which is the opposite side of direct, which means I pivot topics and hop around and say a bunch of words and allow people to select and choose what they do with the information that I provide. Direct communicators have a tendency to deliver the information that was requested, and that's it. What was requested, that's it. And the more informative you are, the more you expand from the point of reference, which is what inspired your podcast. So if you had asked me that question, I'm doing it right now, by the way. I'm hopping around a lot. So if a listener was listening to me, this is what informative communication sounds like. And contrast that to what Brian is doing, which is topic, focus, clear communication relating to the original question. And then mine is hopping around a lot. So Brian is a direct communicator and he is introverted sensing, extroverted intuition access. So now we're down to 4 types. There are only 4 types that have those trends in common.
Okay.
So we have ESTJ, ISTJ, who else would have the direct? So there's 16 in total. So I'm sort of running the 16 through my head, figuring out which ones do which.
So I've done like the tests, the Myers-Briggs analysis or something similar. I think I've mentioned to you in the past what those revealed. Very confused. So I think the last one I took was IN. Is that Okay. So I didn't know if that.
Right. So one thing.
I don't even know what that means right now.
So intuitives have a preference for broad explanatory conversations relating to concepts and theories. They're also hyper future oriented. We want to be projecting into the future. And I say we because I also would represent a member of this category. So let me explain some evidence and then you can decide if that fits. So yeah, I've said up until this point that you are an S. And the points of reference I would use to argue that point are...
What does S mean?
Direct? S means concrete. We don't have to explain anything. It just is. So you say, okay. I talk to my friend.
Okay.
My friend's name is this.
N would be what?
I was on a journey of self-discovery.
In one word, you say concrete for S, and then N would be?
Abstract.
More. Abstract. Okay. Okay. Okay.
So right. I'm communicating in a way an abstract person would be. Like, I was trying to find myself. I was seeking to learn more about who I was. And you're like, this is what I did. And then there might be a little bit of abstraction there. I didn't know what I wanted. But in the end, there are actual data points. This is the name of my friend. This is what happened on the first podcast. This is what we did. Well, this is what I did, actually. Yeah. This is how long it took. Scott, on our first podcast, we did. This is what we're doing now.
Okay.
No one has to wonder. And even as I'm communicating, you can say I'm an abstract communicator because I'm not actually giving the details. You gave the details. You said, Scott, on that podcast, we talked about typology and we talked about your past and there isn't a need to wonder about the material that's being presented. So abstract are these sort of broad conceptualizations. So for instance, if we're talking about the word honor, it's this floaty concept of virtuousness, capacity, perhaps bravery, loyalty. It's an umbrella term for lots of things. A censor would say, my grandpa was honorable. There is a real literal representation of this concept. My grandma was an honorable woman. And then you could say, these are the exact moments in which I felt that my grandma was an honorable woman. And you would pull these things from your personal history attached to this concept. So the concept informs the theory and not vice versa. Okay, I don't want to get too into that.
Yeah. All right. So yeah, keep on going. Do your thing.
Yeah. So right now we have sensing. Okay. We have, and not only do we have sensing, we have that it's introverted sensing. So it's, which attaches in an axis. These two are always together. Introverted sensing and extrovert intuition. They always run in pairs. So extrovert intuition says, this is my past, this is my subjective awareness. This is the physical thing that I experienced and I remember it over time. This is the recipe to success that I've experienced in the past. I will repeat it diligently over and over to avoid chaos and problems. And then extrovert intuition says, how can we pivot this? What could we do? What could happen differently? And then depending on how much you use introverted sensing versus how much you use extroverted intuition, there will be a seesaw or an imbalance in the other direction. So high SI users will struggle with a bunch of chaos occurring. So they seek to create bounds, rules, and structures to alleviate this chaos. So think about the karate master that comes in and says, class, we have arrived. We will ground. We will become calm. These are the rules of the dojo that should be followed so that we can have an ordered and efficient class, right?
He's a sensitive or sensing introvert there. Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Got it. Okay. So now let's pivot just for sake of time. So right now we've done the S and the N. So we lean S. you're a direct communicator. So you're an ISTJ or an ESTJ, essentially. And then, and not that this would distinguish between the two, but the words you're saying are connected to introverted feeling. So as you're talking, you're using words like, I loved it. It was amazing. I found that I was passionate about this. It's personal feeling, personal conviction. This is what I like. I know that I like it. Whether everyone else likes it, we'll find out. But I know that I like it. I know that I'm passionate about it. It'd be cool if everybody else liked it. But I know in my soul that baseball sports is something I enjoy. However, I struggle with starting, right? I struggle with initiating. I struggle with beginning. But since you've begun, you've been going like at a rocket pace, pulling in new things. New things are happening. New things are occurring. But you didn't plan on those things. So what we have is direct responding concrete. And we have, what else do we have? I have a big chart that I just kind of run through my mind when right. I do this. But it's not like having one in front of you. So I actually kind of have to pause and think about things. I think that you're systematic. And I think that you're affiliative.
What's that mean?
Affiliative? It means that group buy-in is important. I'm not going to enforce upon you this worldview that I have. I want to make sure that it dances well with the tribe. I want to make sure that the thing that I'm offering to everyone has consensus and buy-in before I proceed. I'm not going to, like, for instance, you work in the Tumwood School of Life. You have an idea about how to run the call differently. Instead of just doing it, you would probably seek feedback from superiors or feedback from peers prior to applying it.
Yeah.
I don't do that, right? So I would represent the other category, which is pragmatic. I am more likely, I might consider it, but it'll be an afterthought. It'll be like, well, I guess technically I could get some permission here, but I really don't care about it as much. I've had to learn to care. Does that make sense?
It's funny you say that, Scott, because if I were to analyze myself, I would not analyze it in that same way that you articulated. Because I think, oh, I gathered my info, here's how I do it, and then I am doing it my own way. But no, I did go and source. I talked to David before I took over his slot. I talked to him. I talked to a few of the members about how they do it. And then I kind of sourced how it was, not kind of, but I did source from members how it was going, how it was better, how it was worse, and then change it, evolve in these calls. And each one of these calls is different. So it's not the same in every single call because the group's different.
Right.
Also. But there are patterns that are very similar throughout how I've been doing.
Right. Absolutely.
But I learned, I took a lot of information from Jeremy, from Barbara, from David, and a few other people. So
you're still facilitating in your own unique way, but it is bounded by the feedback. You've curated your personal approach through the lenses of the tribe perspective. It's still you. No one else is facilitating in a suit. No one else is facilitating the way that you facilitate. And I'm not just saying that, like, you bring your interest in sports. I don't think the other facilitators have an interest in sports.
Right.
And I'm not saying they're uninterested. It's just that's not the thing that they do. So there are clear personal flavors that are not absent in your call. But prior to the call, you're like, how should we go about running a call better? Or how can we be efficient?
I don't want to run it worse. Well? I don't want to run it worse. But
what I want to do is fail. How can I fail more successfully?
Miserably. Anyway, yeah. No, that's good. I think all this analysis is pretty good because I see this. And if I can go back a little bit, one of my other jobs that I really liked, it was a volunteer job as a high school baseball coach. And all these things apply, like group buy-in, very important for team. Very important. Direct, concrete instructions to the ball players. This is how it's going to be done. Otherwise, we're going to fail. You just have to be on the same mission. Now, I might not want to be that way in my own personal life, but when I get into a professional situation, that's how I believe I have to be in order for any amount of success to be achieved.
Yeah. So after listening to everything, what I'm arriving at is ISTJ.
ISTJ. Okay. That's different than what I've gotten in the past, which was, I believe, INTJ. But I think a lot of that, Scott, as you're talking, because this is a, believe it or not, folks, this 15, 30 minutes, whatever it's been, is a lot deeper analysis than some Scantron sheet or click buttons on a website kind of thing to figure this out. But the thing was, I believe when they ask you questions on these exams or surveys or whatever they're called, it's hard to be completely accurate because if you don't know exactly what they want out of that question, it's hard to answer, like on a scale of 5 or whatever it might be, or very high, very low. It's like, how do I differentiate between high and average or high and very high? I don't know.
It's subjective. Yeah.
Totally subjective. And that maybe that's part of the deal, but it's hard. But I think what I may be doing, could be wrong, or may have done, was project the answers that I, in an ideal situation, that I would like. And that gave me that N thing, because maybe that's who I, by like what we said at the top, from culture, like everything around me, maybe that's who I thought I was supposed to be, or what I was supposed to be like, even though that might not be me.
Yeah, we tend to hyper-focus on loud components of our life. So here's a reference. I have a memory when I was 7. I got trapped out on a balcony and I stepped on a hornet's nest. I remember it vividly. I remember how many hornets stung me. I remember everything about it. We have a tendency to remember anomalous, intense experience. Am I stepping on hornets' nests with enough regularity to say that is a personality trait? No. But do I remember it? Is it very loud in my mind? Yeah. Can I remember it decades after it happened? Absolutely. So what can often happen in these tests is we say, man, I was really sensitive in that one situation 2 weeks ago. I cried in public. That's crazy. I'm a feeler. I'm totally a feeler. And it's, no one else would think that you're a feeler. You don't ever talk about your feelings, but you're like, I am a feeler. I remember that day. It was very intense.
Right.
And
so that's
another thing that can influence those tests.
Yeah. And also like the proximity to when you're taking the test. Obviously, most of the time, memories are more vivid the closer to the time that you actually experience them, but not like this 7-year-old hornet's nest thing. It's still there because it was such a big deal.
Yeah.
I can't imagine. I mean, literally stepping on a hornet's nest. And we talk about that as an idiom or a turn of phrase a lot. And it's like, no, you actually had that happen.
Yeah. It's super triggering.
Right.
It's not, I'm cool. But yeah. So you'll notice these things. And that's why typing can be difficult, because it requires like a pivot between self and tribe. And if you highly value what you think, you won't listen to tribe feedback. If you only value tribe feedback, you won't listen to what you think. And so it's this dance between who is more accurate. And in some ways, each person is going to prefer themselves as the source of the material. For instance, I would say, so with an ISTJ, their own personal values are loud and memorable, and their own likes and dislikes are almost immune to tribe attack. So being yourself is effortless.
Okay. I want to stop you right there, because this is something that's been vexing me for a long time. I agree with that analysis, number one. And I think that fits me. However, I don't believe that it always fit me. And I think from my study of this stuff and from what people tell me is that, no, you're the same personality type all your life. It's like you have, I don't know, you brown hair, but you don't always have brown hair. It changes to gray sometimes, or it might change to red at a certain point in your life. Can you expound on that a little bit? Because
absolutely.
Okay. Please. So,
well, I didn't mean to interrupt you. It sounded like you were flowing.
No. I don't really know how to articulate what I'm asking, other than I know I've changed, or I've realized something about me is different. Right.
Than your personality type? Yeah.
I was operating differently. Now, as the older I've gotten, and particularly the catalyst of 2020 really changed that, is that I do. I absolutely say I fit that description, what you said, the ISTJ, where it's like my values matter. I don't care. I don't really care that much about these other clowns out there who are trying to destroy my life. I have no empathy for them. However, if you're on my side, I have a lot of empathy for you. I tended to I tried to empathize with almost everybody years ago. And I didn't do a good job of it, but that was where I was operating from. You see what I'm saying? Versus now I'm more conscious of where I'm at. I didn't know this about my personality type, say, but I gleaned enough information to say, I have my priorities and my life rules and whatever they might be, and you're not going to change them. Because I've already experienced them, and I've settled on this.
Yeah. So real
not
quick.
To get this into a therapy session, Scott, but anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, all right. Take a seat on the chair. We'll figure out what happened in your childhood.
Yeah.
So what can happen, and I want to bring up something I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, we change. Absolutely, there's nurture. Like, for instance, I can learn how to play basketball, but there are natural abilities and strengths that I have that might make me better or worse at basketball.
Right.
But over time, I'm like, I want to do basketball now. Like, and let's say I decide to do that when I'm 60. That's not the best time to get good at basketball, but you totally could do it. You totally could. And then you'd be the best 60-year-old basketball player, presumably, or something along those lines. So their preferences and interests and focuses can and do change over time. And that doesn't change our core personality. It just changes where we put our emphasis and focus. So for instance, an ISTJ, and again, I'm just saying this from a more systemy kind of look. This is because this can get real complex real quick, but so I'm going to avoid that. But we have with the ISTJ, we'll stick to the Jungian typology stuff, or you could say MBTI. There's a whole bunch of systems involved in this. So just real
MBTI,
quick.
MBTI, Myers-Briggs.
Yeah. Myers and Briggs essentially took Jung's stuff and they're like, how can we turn this into a test? And then they made a test. Okay. That's it. That's what happened there.
Got it.
And so when you have that test, it's Myers and Briggs making a test for Carl Jung's observations. And then you have Dr. Linda Behrens, and she's like, but how do people actually behave? How do they interact? And then Dr. David Kiersey's like, well, what are they kind of like inside their mind? All of these co-inform this big thing that I'm using. And then you have Dr. John Beebe, and he's like, let's look at the exact functions and lenses and what are the cognitive preferences for each of these. It gets really complex really quickly. Mm-hmm. But returning to your question, how is it that I am the thing that you described just now, Scott, but I wasn't really like that when I was younger? Mm-hmm. And the answer is we sort of move down our functional stack as we age. And we're like, oh, so just for reference, we have introverted sensing at the top. So I kind of always know how I'm doing physically. That's not hard for me to do. I kind of always know if I need to sleep. I know if I'm hungry. I know. Just so you know, some people have no clue.
Forrest Gump idea. Whereas I'm hungry. I eat. If I'm tired, I sleep.
Yeah, exactly. And some people, I just want to tell you, are utterly out of touch with their physical experience almost completely. So okay. it basically allows them to work tirelessly without uh-huh. stopping. But of course, it takes a toll on their body, which is fine because they don't notice. And okay. so these are the type of people that can work themselves to death, or they get crazy diseases because they're ignoring their body while they're accruing all this sort of social pressure, work pressure, physiological issues with their diet, and they're able to ignore it all. So it's a okay. superpower and a curse, you could say. And then being highly yeah. attuned, you can't ignore your body. You have right. to just endure either, okay, I'm just going to be hungry, I feel it, and then push past it. So that's kind of what introverted sensing does.
So are the folks that are like Ironmen and ultra marathoners and that type of thing, are you saying that is more of that extroverted sensing where it's
definitely
it's like,
what, yeah, absolutely.
It trends that yeah. way anyway.
It trends strongly that way.
Strongly.
Probably 90%.
Okay.
Would yeah, be right. the extroverted sensing types. I mean, and then there's some crazy SI people that just know how to shut off or endure to a degree that's insane. They are not common, but they are in those realms, but they're rare.
You can kind of tweak that in a way or like to get more attuned to that one side, for instance. I mean, not to be too yeah. abstract, but right now, for in the Catholic religion, it's the season of Lent. And so you're called on to fast. The fasting rules have changed quite a bit over the particular last 50 years or so. However, it's encouraged that fast, and then the term fast means different things to different people. But historically, fasting was no food and oftentimes no water. I have pushed myself over the last several years to fast a few days at a time. And just to see, not only fall on religious practices, but also just to see if I can do it. And like what all these people in the past have done and how they endured it. And this year, honestly, I'm probably not even supposed to talk about it really until the whole thing's done, but I failed a few times where I have it on my calendar. Like today's a fast day. And I'm like, oh, I just can't do it. I got too many things to do. I'm hungry. And I just I'll let it slip. And then I had to double down last week. I just, come on, man, on my calendar. I said, I have something marked out. I'm like, yeah, this means no food for real. For real. And then sometimes it is no eating until like noon or 3 p.m. or whatever and whatever. But the idea is that you can, that's very hard for me. And it's very hard for a lot of people to do that. Some people, it's not, like you said, it's no problem. They have no struggle with fasting because they'll just, like you said, eat whenever or exercise whenever. Like I got to go out for a walk every once in a while just to move the blood, my head straight.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know? And if I just sat here all day, it would be tough. But anyway.
Yeah. It would be bad for you. Yeah. I just thought this was really interesting. So here's a great thing to point out. You asked me, Scott, this is the difference between informative and direct. I just noticed that I did it. You would ask me, Scott, I really identify with what you're saying now, but I didn't used to. What's up uh-huh. with that?
Yeah.
And then I went all over the place and I started talking about fasting. And then you're like, fasting? That's real. I didn't answer your question. I went in all these different directions. Okay. And then we got on fasting. And so I don't know. So that meta analysis, so me uh-huh. looking at what I'm doing and being like, Scott, what are you doing? He actually asked, I have to work really, really hard to just answer the question.
Okay. It's interesting. Okay. Do you have to kind of tweak certain areas of your personality, say, to be effective at the job you do? To raise Absolutely. One, lower the other?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's tiring. Or it's just becoming flexible. You're like, oh, okay, I want to go run really fast. Okay, well, I don't want to be pulling any muscles. Now that I'm running really fast, now I need to go stretch my hamstrings. Oh man, my hamstrings are really tight. Okay, it's just like you're stretching your mind, you're stretching your abilities, you're stretching your capacities to engage with all the different types of people, right? There are the people that would naturally fit you, and then there are people that kind of fit you. And then there's people that don't fit. And then in each case, you have to figure out, can I move how I'm delivering myself in a way that makes this valuable to the other side? In this case, I have to figure out, and then you'll be asking the same questions, but in a different way. Like, am I accomplishing what Scott's setting out to do? Are we being efficient? Are we doing the thing? Like, everybody has a little vision of how things are supposed to go.
Yeah, but it's funny you say that, because I tend to be a bit direct, I guess. I don't see myself that way, but maybe. But I also, before we went on, I said, I didn't say this in these terms, but I'm giving you the runway to take it wherever you want to go, because I'm constrained by time insofar as it's got to be probably done within the next hour. But I said, I think this is a really interesting topic. I really want to get into it because I know you, Scott, and we talk almost every week, and I'm getting glimpses of this, right? So I want you to be able to, and for other people to come in and explore what it is that you do, because and that will give everybody, I think, a better idea of where you're coming from, even more to the point where you mentioned earlier about how you can get tired or exhausted or it's overload kind of thing. And I see that every once in a while. I don't want to get too far out of school. You can stop me at any time here, but there's some days where you've been doing like many of these meetings, or consulting, you know, with a large group, and you're bushed, man. I can tell you're there because you committed to show up, but your day was already over a few hours ago. And
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's
and,
funny.
But the thing is, you come in and I'm understanding why. I'm like, it's just, you're just talking to people. But the other thing you say is I'm exhausted, except I loved it. It was so rewarding. And it's what you do. And so you have the passion. So not only you can work through that exhaustion, just like that ultra marathon runner, if that
right.
makes any sense,
right.
because it's the passion that you have. You're not working through it necessarily. You're accepting it and compartmentalizing it more, if that analysis is correct.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly right. And I suppose if we're going back into what happens in a call, a little more conversational.
BrianDOLeary.com/TSOL if you want to sign up for Tom's School of Life. There you go. Thanks, Scott.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Nice. Yeah. Okay. But if we were on a call, I'd be like, okay, I have to do the thing. So the next steps we would go into. So we type them. And then there's a conversation where they're like, oh, I am that way. Oh, that's so interesting. And then there's this sort of rapport developed. And then they're like, okay, so you get me. So now I can trust your BS stuff, like your little words. And because a lot of times people are like, why am I going to learn all this vocab? Why would I do that if you don't get it? And getting it is typing them and then making sure that they feel that you understand where they're coming from in a cognitive way. Because before that, why would they respect anything that you say? Right? Like, to show your capacity. Yeah. So after that, depending on the type.
Is that universal? That is a universal.
Yeah, that's a universal.
People. Okay.
People need to know that you're not an idiot in the way that they value. like if you're a banker and you're going to have a conversation about banking, you're going to need to hear industry specific terminology. You're going to need to see cleanness in the way that they're organized and present themselves, because it's a numbers game. It's an accounting game. If you're going to be talking to an artist, you're going to want to see an aesthetic that's beautiful and interesting. And that should be representative in their clothing. You won't necessarily be interested. Maybe they will be smart and well-spoken, but it's not necessary that they are, because an artist does this other thing. And then if you're talking to a poet laureate,
you're almost taking it for granted that he or she might not be as articulate or whatever, but you can sense it or whatever from their wardrobe or the way they carry themselves, or more
absolutely.
So than the speech patterns.
Right, right. We're giving off signals all day long.
Yeah.
All day long, we're giving off signals, and we're aware and unaware of a lot of the signals that we're presenting. And just because we don't value those signals doesn't mean that they don't matter. People will judge you for how you present yourself, full stop. They will make determinations. Now, whether they're negative or positive or neutral or objective, they're going to think something based upon what they see. They're going to say, oh, he's beautiful. Oh, he's white. Oh, he wears collared shirts. He likes to be comfy because he's wearing sweats and pajamas. He's highly professional, right? So for instance, someone that sees khakis and a messy button-up shirt, or not a fashionable, but a professional, they're like accountant energy. You're filling the box of like clean, professional, organized rule follower, but you're not beautifully dressed. Does that make sense?
It does make sense quite a bit. And getting back to the dress, if we ever have this on video, you'll see the way I'm dressed in springtime colors, because it stemmed from a conversation that our group had the other night with Scott.
Yeah.
They're kind of making fun of Scott's background. And they're like, well, Scott, you need to match the background with your shirt. It's like, come on. And anyway, so I was like, well, all these pastel colors. I said, well, I'll show up on Saturday when I'm recording this with Scott, and I'll show him that I can
match my background.
I can match the background, or any background, with my wardrobe. Anyway, there's the train. What I was going to get to as far as wardrobe goes. So some people say, oh, yeah, I'm comfy because I wear a T-shirt and sweats. Well, yeah, that's comfy for me at a certain part of the day. At night, I'm not comfortable at all going to the grocery store in sweatpants and a T-shirt. That freaks me out. I'm almost not dressed at that point. But some people are perfectly fine, right?
Yep.
Yeah. And then some people need to get in their formal pajamas and to even think about going to sleep. I, like you said earlier, I'll go to sleep when I'm tired. Sometimes it's just I'll fall asleep in all of my clothes and I just fall asleep.
Yep.
But it does. Yeah. I do get more comfortable when I get into that mode of sleep. And now on these podcasts, I don't care what the other person wears. But for me, doing this job, I feel a lot more comfortable in a collared shirt. And I usually wear a sport coat if I'm in any moderately professional, or a sweater or something, depending like how I'm feeling. But that's just kind of what I do. And I'm comfortable that way. So other people are perfectly comfortable in T-shirt. I don't care. Now, if you came to the office in sweatpants and a T-shirt and a whole pair of worn out sneakers, it's just, I'm going to be thinking about that all the time. And it's just not going to work, right? But on the Zoom call or on, you know, whatever, that it's perfectly fine. Because we see pretty much everybody from the shoulders up. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, we're sort of getting into like just idiosyncratic behavior. With
not
with
personality.
People. No, I'm not. Well, no, but okay. But when we're talking about to label it, we're having a conversation about comfort. And then we're looking at a spectrum of personal comfort to the exclusion of societal preferences and social awareness, right? That's really the conversation we're having. So if I was oblivious to the experience I was presenting other people, it would not be a problem to be a slob because it wouldn't be hitting me in the face that I was failing to adhere to standards of behavior, because all I was aware of was my own personal experience.
You're like 99.9% intuition, right? Or introverted sensing.
Well, right. And regardless of whether we label, but yes. Yeah. And in that case, actually, so that's usually the NPs, especially the INTPs. Like my type has an easy tendency to just ignore everything. I have stains on my shirt, whatever. You know, it's not a big deal. Because we have what's called a trickster function, and our trickster function represents extroverted sensing, which is the experience that you're giving other people. The experience that you're giving other people is extroverted sensing. Your seventh function you're blind to, and you don't even know you're terrible at it. You have no idea you're terrible at your seventh function. So there's eight total. There's four that you're aware of, one that you're kind of bad at, one that you're effortlessly good at, two that are kind of balanced in the middle. And then these ones that pop into your consciousness under duress. They'll pop into your consciousness when problems emerge that you are struggling to handle. And then they're like, okay, like for instance, if you're obsessed with what you think, obsessed with what you think, obsessed with what you think, finally one day you're like, I'm going to listen to the tribe. I'm going to finally humble myself and get some feedback, right? Or it would be like, I'm obsessed with how I'm feeling. I'm obsessed with how I'm feeling. I'm obsessed with my mood and my stuff. I'm going to pay attention to how the tribe's doing. Every now and then we'll pivot into these sides of ourselves that we would rather not, unless under duress, unless a stressful event has occurred that forces us to use what are called shadow functions. And our shadow functions are used consciously, like they know they're doing it, by other personality types. They're just unconscious for us, right? Some people are hyper aware of the experience they're giving. They look fantastic all the time, and they're trying to look fantastic. If they're uncomfortable, who cares? What matters is looking good, right? And then the SI people are like, yeah, but who cares about looking good if you feel uncomfortable all day, right?
Yeah, right.
And so there are these dichotomies, but there exist people that don't give a crap about how comfy they are. They don't care. They don't care.
It's the high heels. Some women will wear them all the time, and some women will just wear them only at some highbrow function and only for a certain amount of time, because
and then they're mad and then they're like, oh, thank God. Yeah, and then they take off all their stuff and they're like, oh man, the patriarchy oppresses me to wear these heels. And it's this sort of animosity for, and some are like, thank goodness I get to look great. And they're like, yes, these rules are not oppressive. This is the race I want to win. I'm cool with all the rules. And it's just weird what we chafe against as people. Like, what can we not put up with?
So like, let me ask you a question on that last topic of the trickster function. If you were to analyze me right now, what, and maybe you've said it already, and that might be the trickster in me, but what is, would you gather would be my trickster function that I'm unaware of?
That I'm
unaware of or bad at?
Unaware of and bad at, because you're unaware. It's hard to be good at something that you're unaware of. I guess in theory, it's possible. Essentially, you, in order to get good at it, you have to pretend to care, and that takes effort. So you have to have really good reasons to pretend to care. And then eventually, by mirroring other people displaying that skill, you can accrue it and develop it for yourself. Mimic it. You can pretend to do it. And at a certain point, you will accrue the capacity, the muscle memory. So essentially, if you had no nerve endings in your legs, right, but they still have the skeleton, you could learn to walk. You could learn to walk, but no one would look at you and be like, he's walking real good. Yeah. He's doing a great job. You'd be like this. You'd be, because you don't have any nerve endings there, but you can walk. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. What would you say my trickster function might be or is?
Oh, extroverted feeling. So I will ignore and not process my emotional response to a thing. What really matters is how everyone else is feeling. Like, it doesn't matter about my experience. It matters, is the vibe being respected? Are we cool?
Okay, so you're saying that I'm valuing the feelings and thoughts of others more so than my own? Is that
opposite?
I'm valuing my own feelings more so than that of the group.
Yeah, and I want to be clear, this is not an accusation. I want to just label it, because oftentimes it can. It's like, hey, this, you're bad at this. Like,
so,
and it's, yeah.
It's valid, and I'm thinking about it in terms of my things I've done in the past, and particularly with coaching, like ball coaching. It translates to what I'm doing now a little bit, but a lot of coaching conventions and stuff, a lot of coaches say, yeah, we just got to be empathetic to our ball players, our fellow coaches, all this stuff. And it's like, man, you're not just pressing a button and producing empathy for people. And I think it's and I don't know, I've struggled with defining empathy, and I've done a lot of reading about it. And one of the books I read is, yeah, there's no such actual thing as empathy. It's like always a kind of the carrot and the stick. It's always out there. You're never going to get it. You're never going to get true empathy, but it's a standard or something to reach for. The ideal is up there, but the reality really doesn't exist. I don't know where you come out on that, or if you've ever thought about it or do that at all, but I tie that into the extroverted feeling is more empathetic in nature. There's two kind of competing thoughts, perhaps, but
to clarify. Oh, and I want to be in case there's any misunderstanding, and I'm not saying you misunderstood. FI says, it's the definition of sympathy. I have felt this thing, therefore I can understand the feeling that you have. I am not taking on your feeling. I am feeling from myself with you because right. I too have felt that. So it's coming from within.
Yeah, sympathy is different than empathy.
And empathy, by definition, is I don't really know. And maybe I have had experience with that, but it's not necessary. Like the other day, I have extroverted feeling. I got really sad all of a sudden because the person in front of me was getting sad. And I was like, oh no. And I could feel all the feelings. Like it wasn't my stuff. And it was just like, oh, you are sad. And I knew how they felt. And it had nothing to do with something I had felt in the past. It was just taking on like the emotional experience of the people nearby me. And the higher up the extroverted feeling is, the more intense and aware you are. And usually because you're more sensitive to it, it affects you more, right?
Yeah, no. We probably got a few more minutes, Scott, don't we? This is fun. But I have these meetings on occasion, every couple of weeks, with the other facilitators within Tomwood School Life. And we talk about anything and everything related to the school about it. And some of them know other members and perhaps better than even I do. And one of the facilitators was talking about a member and, oh, like this and this. I said, I didn't even pick up on that. I had no idea about a personality trait. And I'm like, it's starting to make sense why this behavior and that behavior exhibit. Good, great people, all of them. But it's no wonder I can't quite get through. I didn't even recognize that. But that's what you're saying is going back to probably more of that extroverted feeling, because it's harder for me to, because it's more concrete what I'm seeing. You tell me this, I take in that.
Yes.
And
subtext. And, what is subtext? Get that out of here. Let's just stay real. Quit with this weird fill in the blank mess. Yeah. So, why would we do that when we could just not do that?
But when that was exposed to me, then I start thinking, I'm like, I got to look a little deeper than what just the words coming out at me are, because I need to see that a little more. Not with that member, with everybody. It was a real breakthrough, actually.
It gets so complicated once you start doing that. You're like, oh, no, it's too much.
And I can see how, particularly with your personality type, how that can be exhausting.
Yeah.
You're on all the time. If I were doing podcasts all day long, every day, radio hosts, for crying out loud, 4 hours is a long day for them. And then you get some of the big guys who have a 3 or 4 hour radio show and then an hour of television. And that's a big day. I'm like, we all work like 8, 9, 10 hours a day doing whatever we're doing. It's not like getting on air like that. It sounds fun to me, not exhausting, but again, different personality types.
Yeah. Yeah. I was talking to my business partner the other night. Mm-hmm. And she said, Scott, is it too late to have a conversation about, and essentially the topic was analyzing complex data, analyzing complex people stuff, doing personality typing. And I was like, Jenny Lynn, even when I'm exhausted, this is the easiest energy to summon. This is the easiest thing that I can do. When I am dead tired, I can do it.
You mean too late in the day to talk about
it? It was around 11:30 p.m.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So late.
Not late in your business relationship, but late in the physical day.
In the evening. So essentially the physiological effects of lack of rest are going to start emerging later, unless you regularly go to bed at that time, which I don't. Yeah. But it's the easiest thing in the world to do that. Now, if you wanted to have me be highly emotionally connected with you, fully available, I'm going to need like a 5-hour warm-up. I'm going to need to be fresh in the morning to do a good job. Right. Like I could do a really terrible job about taking on your emotional experience and being sympathetic, kind, and caring. I can totally do that. I can, but not in abundant doses. And it's very hard to do when I myself am tired. Whereas analyzing and cohering data and figuring out patterns and conclusions, I can do that when I haven't slept for 2 days. I would do it poorly. I can still do it. And I think that's the difference. Is like so those dominant functions, we always can do them. It's like breathing.
Right. So is this brings me to another example. When you mention that, and is this more like a nuance of behavior or is this a personality type that you would do this or not do it? So, oh yeah, I'm available, but I'm just cashing it in, but I'm available. I'll do it. Or would you prefer to just not do it at all until you have that 5-minute warm or that 5-hour warm up? Or does it matter?
Because the answer is that's a spectrum. And certainly some personality types will lean in the direction that you described and some will lean in the other direction you described. So the NPs don't mind half-assing it. Like they'll show up and do a crappy job because they're like, at least something's getting done. People are like, well, if you started it, you should finish it. And it needs to be finished properly. So those guys just don't start, right? So if you're does that make sense? If you're terrified of leaving a project incomplete, probably won't start it unless you know that you have the energy to complete it. And what if it's one of those huge energy sucking, life changing projects? It just means you'll never do it unless like an asteroid hits the earth and then it's time to change. And then you're like, I'm going to go. So it takes some Herculean effort. right. And then, okay. And the flip side is the people that start things, it's almost impossible to finish. And so they're like, man, isn't it cool that Brian O'Leary is able to be a coherent and he stays responsible? Wow, I'm so envious. But they don't know how hard it was to begin.
It's the getting going is often, people are stuck a lot. And I talk about this a lot. I have here, I don't know if we have it on video, but I have this kind of like offensive coordinator's play sheet, you know, for things that come up a lot of time in our calls. And one of the things I say, I have just in this one square, it says stuck, some ideas to get unstuck. Define your mission. Do something mindlessly boring. Don't dwell on this thing. And do something that's totally unrelated, but that's also interesting and creative. You might have a different system to do that because I haven't changed this since we had a talk. It's like you just want to, you want to do the opposite almost to get unstuck, I think, from your personality, Scott. Sometimes you'd want to be still.
Yeah, I desire.
Yeah, it's a different thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, I wanted to get back to this point. I saw this interview, YouTube. It was David Letterman, early days, interviewing Christopher Reeve, just not too long after, maybe when he was, you know, early days of the Superman franchise. And he said, oh man, it must have been great working with Marlon Brando. He's like, actually, no, it sucked. I think that was the language. He's like, it sucked. He's like, whoa. He's like, he's great. He's like, don't get me wrong. He's a great actor. Actually liked working with him, but he just mailed it in. He just mailed it in. He can do that. And he can essentially do that work in his sleep. He was just there to do the job and give nothing back. And honestly, probably the way I interpret it, he took nothing in. He was just there literally to do the job. So he got no personal interaction with folks. And that was the thing that bugged Christopher Reeve the most. Not that he got the $2 million. He said, fine, he earned it. He's a great actor, right? But there was no personal communication or interaction, really, with this great person, this supposed great actor and person, and this new up-and-coming actor that wanted to show the world what he can do. And it felt kind of like he got cheated.
I had a call with my longest client. I've been working with him for a couple of years. And we had a conversation about effort. And that isn't the same thing as succeeding. Because you can fail, but there's still, okay, and we want success. We want people to deliver the goods. But we worship, or worship is perhaps not the precise word, but effort means something. Effort means, yes. I can't say what it means, but like when you see, okay, let's say ultimately a kid is trying out on a team and he is not as good as mm-hmm. the other soccer players. He's not as good as the other baseball players. We'll use baseball. He can't hit it, but like in practice, no one is hustling like he is. He's the chubby boy with asthma, and he's just running, and he's like falling over because he's running so hard. His little heart is pounding. He's like 5'1". All the other boys are 5'5", but he's almost keeping up. But what he's working with is so much worse in terms mm-hmm. of like physical acumen. And there's something so inspirating. You're just like, yes. Totally.
It's awesome.
And I was talking to him about that, and it's like effort, and I can't remember what came out of it, but it was just like, don't forget how meaningful effort is. People will remember that you worked hard. And here's the thing. So that's the cool thing with typing people is you can know when they're on hard mode, when they're doing the thing that they're terrible at, because they love you or because they value your relationship, they're going to do the thing that they hate doing on your behalf, and they'll do bad. They actually won't do a good job at it. Your kids will make the burnt scrambled eggs and the weird pancakes for the bed and breakfast. And you're like, this is gross. Thank you. But you can feel that gratitude for the failure because you know how difficult the feat was for the person that's presenting it to you. And so there's something to this concept of effort.
Yeah, I see that loud and clear with my experience in coaching baseball and even playing baseball. Like I loved those type of guys on my team. I didn't care if they played, if they got a hit, but I knew they were going to give it all they got for the other people, for our team. And I saw that in a major way. Some of the kids I would play, like, wow, like I'm starting? Like, hey, you earned it. Just go out and show it. And if you don't show it, then, you know, you're back on the bench, but you earned it. He didn't. And then it's even better when these guys go out and perform at that level, because then it builds the team. Not that we're talking more personality here, but like typing people, if I'd known more about this stuff, I would have been much more informed and much more confident in those decisions. It was a gut decision, you know, and you see a lot of pro sports coaches or baseball managers or whatever. They go they call it old school. They go on gut. And they're like, they poo-poo all the analytics these days. Well, I'm like, you gotta have both. You have to know the stuff. And you have to have a good instinct, but instinct often is developed over time based on all these things and experiences you have seen over time. And you pay attention to them. You pay attention to these things that happen. It's not just like, I got this, you know, like queasy feeling in my stomach. I better pinch hit so-and-so for so-and-so, and then we're going to win the game. That's a bunch of crap. It's BS. It doesn't work. I mean, it might be working luck, but it's not a strategy by any means.
Yeah, like in the end, I think effort is the leaven in the bread, right?
Okay, yeah.
No matter what, you need the bread because you'll starve to death and you can't eat yeast, right? You could eat yeast, but that's not really calorically dense. But a really great loaf of bread needs yeast. So think about a regular team that does a really good job, and then think about if they had a wildly effortful player or handful of players in that team that raised the performance of the team beyond a career player to striving and working. So think of the Kobe Bryant, the Michael Jordan, Shaquille O'Neal.
Go to a good team, to a championship team is what happens.
That's exactly right. Sorry, I didn't mean to interject, but that you get it. That's the point I was trying to make.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm gonna leave it here. We're talking baseball. Scott probably is a little uncomfortable talking baseball, but we'll do it anyway. And yeah. I have made this really, it's like a huge book if I were ever to get back into coaching again. And I have all these systems and practices and whatever. But I have, and it's not personality types, but certain traits that I want in players and coaches with examples from big league baseball. And there's this fellow, Johnny Gomes, who played on several championship baseball clubs. He was one of these guys that everybody wanted on his team because he would raise the level. He was a good player, not a great player, but a pretty darn good player most of his career. But he was a teammate. He raised the level of all these people. And I see that. And when I was growing up, I guess I was just naturally kind of that way. I never consciously thought about it. Getting back to an earlier point we made, like I never consciously thought about that. But as I got into the coaching realm, I'm like, oh, that's what I want. I want that guy on my team. I want a bunch of those guys. I don't care if so-and-so or so-and-so isn't that guy, but I want all those gap fillers to have this way of thinking, this way of going after it. And I think that works. And that has brought me over to, say, even the work we do every week, Scott, where I see it now. Not everybody is capable to share, and we don't even need to share things that we're not comfortable with, but not everybody does what they do within these small groups. And it's relatively low stakes, what we're doing, not something you get when you go with Scott, but you know, I can see, all right, oh, I know this guy or this girl, woman, this man or this woman is going to help fill the gap to raise the level of this entire group. And it's not, I'm not picking and choosing like, oh, this guy's bringing it down, she's raising it up, or he's raising it up, he's bringing it down. No, if the entire, I think of it as a team, if they all come together and their roles, everybody has a role, whether they know it or not, and it works. It just flat out works 90% of the time, 95% of the time. It works pretty darn well. And I have to thank you and all the other members for just making this, particularly understanding that and knowing that and making these things go well week after week, because I didn't know, honestly, I didn't know what I was getting into.
Yeah, effort is essentially the cement between the bricks. You still want uncracked, strong bricks.
Uh-huh.
You also need the thing that holds them all together.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's the in sports, they have a expression for there's a glue guy on the team, a glue guy.
Yeah, there it is.
What do they call him? And you know, you hear that over and over, and sports writers often write things they don't even know what they're talking about, but they hear it from somebody else. But if you know these things, if you start studying these things, the better off you're going to be, whether you go to sports or business or, frankly, like being a barber or a cab driver like I once was. And I was like, these things, you're going to be just better at what you do the more you learn about people. And I think it's wonderful. But any last words, Scott, before we say a bit adieu for at least for now? We can put a bookmark in this and continue.
Yeah. Well, no, I was going to say amen. It was great to be on the pod. Great to be on the podcast.
Appreciate it. Yeah. So let's send the good folks out there to Tools with Scott. Like I said, there's a coming soon new website, should be done. All right. And then book a one-to-one call with Scott. He can go more into depth or less into depth, however you want to do it.
All my contact info is on the retreat website, And then if you're in Tom Wood's School of Life, you can direct message me. I'm the only Scott Fish book in the school, so that's okay. Pretty safe.
Yeah, just direct message Scott if you're in the school. And if not, if you want to get into the school, like I said earlier, briandeoleary.com/TSOL stands for Tom's School of Life. It's a wonderful program, and Scott's attested to it in the past, and I attest to it now. Good. We meet some great people. And I would say this last Friday on a call, one of the members just said, without Tom Woods even being there, he said, kudos to Tom for bringing us all together. I was like, yeah, I wouldn't know a guy like Scott. There's no way I would ever met him. And now I do. And it's wonderful. Yeah. And I appreciate it. And I appreciate all the folks in my life. And anyway, with that being said, we will catch you later, folks. And I appreciate you spending all this time with us. Thank you. For more of our podcasts, head on over to briandeoleary.com. And while you're over there, sign up for our email list. We'll send you daily emails. You can also find the link for our Substack page and various other resource pages we have. And that's at briandeoleary.com.